We will get some practical advice and some valuable information on your money today. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here and will explain a recent ban on certain soaps and cleaning products. He also discusses a milestone for a pioneering investment vehicle, shares some tips on getting through the checkout line at the grocery store a little faster, and will also answer your personal finance questions. So do you have one? What's your personal finance question for Kevin? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet one at Joy Cardine Show. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He usually joins us from our studios in Eau Claire, but now he joins us in our studios in Madison. Good morning, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
Real treat to have you in Madison.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, your favorite soap or cleaning product may have been banned by the FDA, by the Food and Drug Administration. Did you know that, Kevin?
I had actually heard of it, and it's apparently a victory for not only consumers, but also the environment. The FDA has banned 19 ingredients that fall under the category of antimicrobials. And these are found in many antibacterial soaps and cleaning products. The FDA, first of all, said they really don't do what they say they do. They don't have a measurable effect, and they don't do anything more so than regular soap. But they also say they may be causing harm not only to the users, but to others as well.
Oh, so bummer. What chemicals are affected here?
The biggest one is triclosan and triclocarbon. And when these things first came out and these ingredients were used in these antimicrobials products, it wasn't that big of a deal. But now so many people use them that they started showing up in the waste system and downstream and affecting the water quality and wildlife. And to the individuals who not only use it, but who come in contact with them on a repeated basis, they may damage the endocrine system. The NRDA says it may scramble hormones in children and promote drug-resistant infections and trigger other serious diseases.
Yeah, I use these soaps too, so I'm kind of like, uh-oh. And I guess I won't be using them anymore. And are there other antibacterial products, though, that are still going to be allowed?
Right. You still may see these on the shelves. Just because they're on the shelves doesn't mean they're necessarily dangerous. Some of these products may have already reformulated the chemical makeup, so that they don't have any of the banned ingredients in there. Hand sanitizers that contain triclosan are still going to be allowed, as will wipes and gels, etc. Hospitals can still use them, and many food workers can still use ingredients that contain triclosan.
I'm going to blame the hospitals for recommending I use these soaps prior to a surgery some years ago.
Right.
And then I started getting, I might as well. If it was good before that surgery, I'll
keep
do it
going,
again.
Right. Yeah. And I'm glad you said before surgery, rather, because I find it offensive when other people just recommend things about my personal hygiene anyway. So, no, but you might still be ingesting triclosan if you use Colgate Total, which fought the FDA on this and said it's really good at reducing plaque and gum disease. And they said the risks do not outweigh the rewards. So far, that's the only toothpaste that uses it. But other dentists have said if you're concerned about ingesting triclosan by using Colgate Total, look instead for stannous fluoride, which they said is safer and does the job just as well.
All right. So are we going to be less clean because of this?
That's okay. If you notice a funk in the office in the next few weeks, it's because people aren't using their favorite antibacterial soap. Yeah, the liquid gels seem more sanitary because it's just a pump on there. But those are actually mostly water. You might get about 125 pumps out of a typical 7.5 ounce bottle of liquid soap. And bar soap costs maybe 1/10 of that, especially if you buy the bar soap in bulk. And the FDA says, they have it actually up on their website, they said that the bar soap is not only a much better deal, but it's actually much, much less expensive. Yeah. And does the job just as well. And if you ever stay at a hotel, you get your bar soap for many more weeks after that point.
As someone who just got back from traveling, I can attest to that.
You load it up. Good for you.
But But yeah, I can imagine though, because those soaps that I have been purchasing are a little bit expensive. Mm-hmm. So it's probably a good idea that I just use that hotel stuff. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. On Your Money at WPR.org is the email address, or you can post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Here's an email from a listener named Bill. He writes, "My son is going to college next year. We are going to file the FAFSA in January. We have some money in our savings account that we save for emergency reasons and some of my son's college. I understand this will affect his chances in getting financial aid. Would it be a smart move to withdraw that money from the bank and keep it in cash so that these assets do not appear on the checking and savings account statements submitted to FAFSA?"
Well, there is no false praise in this question,
but
there are so many misconceptions that we're very glad to clear all of these up. An understandable sentiment by Bill is he wants to qualify for as much financial aid as he can get. But first of all, the financial aid form is usually has been available for the following fall in January 1st of that year. So if kids going to school in the fall of 2017 would start filling out the FAFSA, the financial aid form, on January 1st of 2017. But starting on October 1st of 2016, they have bumped back the date. So now you can start filling out the form as of October 1st of 2016. We're going to be covering in the next few weeks. But in the meantime, if you or someone you care about is going to be going to a higher education institution in the fall of 2017, you want to go to FAFSA.ed.gov, FAFSA.ed.gov, to get more information on the financial aid forms and process. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
So will Bill's savings or the parents' savings hurt the amount of financial aid awarded?
It's highly unlikely. The federal financial aid formula uses something called the expected family contribution, the EFC, where they add up your income, your assets, and there's a formula they use to determine how much your family has to come up with before any need-based financial aid is awarded. And because these savings, if they're truly in Bill's name, not in the kid's name, it will be counted as a parental asset. And the most a parental asset will count towards the EFC is 5.6% in the formula. So let's say even if Bill had $100,000 in the savings account, only about $5,600 would count towards the family's expected family contribution before any need-based financial aid is awarded. And if you want to see how your situation will pan out, you can go to that FAFSA website I just mentioned and look at the FAFSA forecaster, FAFSA forecaster with the number 4, and you can put in your information. You don't submit it to anyone, but it'll tell you, give you a rough idea of how much need-based financial aid your family might qualify for.
What about Bill wondering if is there any merit in moving the assets to qualify for more financial aid?
You can try to do that, but it's difficult to do in the last minute. Now they're actually looking at the prior year, they're calling it. So they look at your financial situation basically 2 years before you're applying for financial aid. So any moves that you do at the last minute are not going to really shelter anything. Keep in mind, and especially it sounds like Bill, this is the first time he's had a child going to college. People who have gone through this process understand that the majority of financial aid is actually loans that have to be repaid, not grants and free money. Grants still may have a net higher cost. A lot of people say, well, my kid got a scholarship to some liberal arts college of $10,000 a year. Well, the net cost was still $45,000 a year that they had to come up with themselves. They might find a more affordable option someplace else even after the scholarship. And if you move money around and try to do other things, you might have other side effects to doing so. For instance, a lot of people know that home equity is not counted in the financial aid process, so they pay off their mortgage with some extra savings, hoping to qualify for more aid. But then guess what? You don't have a lot of extra money set aside in your rainy day savings account. But we're going to cover that next week, talk a little bit about how to make sure you do qualify for aid that you really do need.
Sounds good. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Lori in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. One, how long do you have to keep your tax statements, the bank statements, and like property tax bills that you get, for filling out your taxes? I've gotten conflicting information on that, 4 years or 7 years. And the other question is, what about inheritance tax? If you inherit a house, but you plan on living in it, how much do you have to pay for that once the person, the parent, dies?
Right. Laura, you should save those statements. Usually for 3 years is pretty reasonable, and the IRS even has a little special code where they say if you're lying on your taxes, you need to save your things for a lot longer.
I was gonna say, so there's a third option for you, and
there's a fourth.
A
third option. Right. So at least 3 years for it. Longer if you're establishing cost basis and securities, but otherwise 3 years. And the good news is today is there are a lot of different places you can go to get that information. Again, the IRS has a service that allows you to get copies of old tax returns if you need them for whatever reason, and many investment firms store those documents online as well. So you should keep everything pertaining to a particular tax year for at least 3 years after you file the taxes. Now, in terms of the inheritance tax, generally there's no inheritance tax on homes or any other kind of asset. You might have to pay some kind of gains tax if the house is given to you beforehand, or there might be a gift tax to it. But generally, if a person owns a home and that person passes away and gives the home to you, there's going to be no inheritance tax on it at all.
Thanks for the call, Lori. I'm thinking that I save my tax forms forever because I just kind of put them in a drawer.
They're fun to look at.
I know.
Yeah, right.
But most of it's online now, too. Doesn't it just kind of stay there forever, too?
Yeah, it does, for better or for worse. But, yeah, you can go back and get it. And most people understand that. Usually there are very few instances where, you know, people will say, well, where's this document from 1974? And you go, oh, gosh. Oh,
that one I don't have, yeah. You're listening to On Your Money. Coming up, we will look at a milestone for a pioneer investment vehicle and how it's shaping up today. We'll also take more of your personal finance questions for financial planner Kevin McKinley. 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org or post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Money is on our mind during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. He is here to take your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up in just a few minutes, we will talk about Vanguard's First Index Investment Trust, which is an investment vehicle that's turning 40 this year. And we'll talk about whether that's something you should consider. But to the phones again, and Donna in Milwaukee next. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I hope everything's going well with both of you today.
Pretty good. Thanks for asking.
My son received kind of an inheritance from his grandfather when his grandfather died. And his sister was made like a custodial over the money until my son turned 18. His sister does not want to have to deal with the account any longer and wants to give him the money now, and he's 16. He received it when he was like 11 or 12. Anyway, he is trying to think of the best way to put this money aside so that it will gain whatever it needs to gain until he turns 18. And I was telling him that he should put it in like an IRA or something like that, so that it's there. And I'm trying to give him advice, but I'm not very good at this myself.
You're doing okay,
yeah,
Donna.
You're good.
And you came to the right place. Good for you for looking out for your son. if the sister doesn't want responsibility for it, someone else still has to be the custodian for it, because he's not, by definition of the state law, he's not an adult. And so someone has to be the custodian for the money under, it's probably set up under what's known as a uniform transfer to minor act, I think, that UTMA account. And so you can do it, somebody else can do it, but somebody else has to be in charge of it. About how much money is it, Donna?
It's $2,000, and this was not going through a lawyer or anything.
Sure.
This was just a verbal agreement to my father-in-law's sister.
Okay. And is it currently set up under that kind of account with his Social Security number, or is it in her name?
It's in his name and her name in the account.
Okay. That's probably what I mentioned about a minor account. He can put it in an IRA, but he has to have earnings on which to base it. And if he does do that, I'd suggest he set up a Roth IRA. But he can just put it in a savings account. And if you do want to keep it safe, that's the best place for it. You're not going to earn much in interest on it, but at least when he's 18 and he can take control of the money, if my understanding of the account titling is correct, he can take control of the money and then he can do with it whatever he wants.
Okay, because she was telling him that he could do whatever he wants with it. Now she just wants to not have that account in her name.
Nope, absolutely. And but he does have to have some adult, maybe even you, who would be willing to be the custodian for it. It's not an incredible amount of work. There might be a little bit of tax additions that you have to add, but it won't be earning a ton of money because you'll have it in a relatively low-risk investment. Therefore, you won't have a lot of taxes on it.
Okay, but with him only being 16, is he going to have to pay, like, a gift tax or inheritance tax or anything on it?
Nope. No gift tax, no inheritance tax whatsoever.
Thank you, Donna, for the call. 1-800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question that you'd like to run by financial planner Kevin McKinley, you can also email us on yourmoney@wpr.org or post it on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And, hey, we even got a question via Twitter the other day, so you can tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Paul wrote on Facebook, I hope Kevin can talk about the possibility of negative interest rates and what this means for retirees and other modest investors like me and my wife. How can banks, etc., take interest money from our savings? Who gets the money? What negative interest rates, Kevin? What in the world's that?
Several central banks around the world, which is the equivalent of our Federal Reserve, have set interest rates at a negative amount. And it's not a significant negative amount. It might be 0.25%. They're doing that ostensibly to spur people to take money out of the bank and do other things with it, invest it, spend it, whatever. It's a completely erroneous assumption, because what actually happens is, especially with individuals, is we don't say, oh, well, I better get this out of there because it's not earning any money. We say, oh, I better save even more than I'm already saving because I'm not earning any money on my savings, therefore I can't spend anything on it. It also encourages banks, hopefully, to loan that money out because the interest rates are lower. They don't loan it out at a negative interest rate. That would be a nice thing to have. But they do have interest rates that are lower than what they would otherwise be. We haven't seen it in the United States yet. I do not think we will. In fact, the Federal Reserve is signaling that they may raise interest rates up. Mm-hmm. You won't see a significant bump up in your savings for savings interest when and if that happens. But it's more likely that interest rates are raised rather than lower down to below zero. But it's a very controversial move for lots of reasons. And even the banks aren't very crazy about it, because the banks have lots of money to invest. And if they're also getting negative interest rates, it hurts their performance as well. So I don't think we'll see it here. You're not going to see a very high rate. That's the bad news about it. And it does mean that you have one of two choices. Either you have to just settle for the interest, or you have to take more risk with your money. But then that, of course, might mean you might get more reward, but you also get more potential losses.
We'll go back to the phones and take our next caller, Patricia in Madison. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning. I have a question about my father is selling his house and moving into a nursing home, and he'd like to gift his three kids the maximum amount of money that he can without tax implications. But I have done the calculation to know that within about 5 years, his estate will run out of money, and then the state will take over paying for the nursing home. My question is, I had read somewhere that after a certain amount of time, or within a certain amount of time, the state can take the money back that he has gifted to us. Does Kevin know anything about that?
Kevin does know anything about that. The
not surprised.
Well, I'll make it up if I don't. Yeah. It's a very good question, Patricia. The system generally works a few different ways, and there are a few different different factors at work here. One is the gift tax, and that is that your father can give up to $14,000 to anyone else he wants to in any given year without paying gift taxes and without filing a gift tax return. And so that part about it is not an issue as long as it's less than $14,000. If it's more than that per person, then he has to file a gift tax return, but probably not pay any taxes on the transfer. In terms of qualifying for public assistance for nursing home and long-term care expenses, there's a look-back period when you apply for public assistance that's 5 years. And they basically say, hey, we're going to look at everything you did in the last 5 years. And if you tried to give money away so that you could qualify for aid, we're going to say, no, we're only going to award you enough to offset what you had at above and beyond what you gave away. So if he, let's say the total bill is $200,000, but he gave away $50,000, they would say, we're only going to give you $150,000 because you're trying to avoid your own assets being used to pay for care that you need. So there not only is a 5-year look back period when he applies for public assistance, but in some states there even is a provision where they can go back to the estate and say, well, this estate, the Medicaid system, let's say, or the public assistance program incurred expenses that were still part of the estate. So after the person passes away in question, we're going to go back in and look at the estate. So it's a very complicated system. If he wants to give the money, he can, but there's really no easy way to get rid of it and still have it at his disposal.
Right. But if in this 5-year look-back period, and do you know if Wisconsin is one of those states?
Wisconsin, as my understanding, is not one of those states yet, but a lot can change in 5 years,
right.
Especially
yeah.
in the you know the public assistance program is not swimming in funds, and the more people who try to avoid it paying for the care that they need, the more depleted the funds are going to be, and therefore the more strict they're going to be on what people can and can't do before qualifying for public assistance.
So then would it be not advisable to
I wouldn't advise it, and especially because whoever the money's given to may spend it, or they may lose it
right.
in a divorce
yeah.
or an accident or something and get sued. And then if they spend it and the state says, well, I'm really sorry, I don't know how you're going to pay for this, but we're only going to give you a portion of the money that your father actually needs.
Right. So it's better to have him keep the money and then see what happens.
It's very tough to do that, Patricia. But yes, mm-hmm. it's a figurative bite the bullet situation where mm-hmm. you just say we're going to keep what we have and hope for the best.
Thank you, Patricia, for the call, and good luck to you and your father and the family. Wendy in Appleton is with us now. Hi, Wendy.
Good morning.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. My husband is selling his former home. We're looking at clearing about $60,000 or so. I'm 53. He's 60. We're looking at about 10 to 15 years to retirement, perhaps. And it might go for a purchase of a smaller home within 10 years, but we're not sure. And we're not sure what to do with what we're going to get from the sale, besides put it in a savings account at a fraction of a percent interest. Is there mm-hmm. something else we can do?
Nothing safe that's going to earn you more than a fraction of a percent interest. You can look at certificates of deposit at various institutions, Wendy, and if you go yeah. very long in the maturity, like 5 years or so, usually you'll get something close to 1.5%, maybe 2% if you shop around. The only thing to be concerned about that is if you need that money before it matures, there may be a penalty for early withdrawal. And mm-hmm. as long as that penalty is only about 6 months or a year's worth of interest, I'm still okay with that. But sometimes institutions say, well, you're going to lose all your interest, or you're going to lose 10% of the value, or worse yet, it's going to be a market-based adjustment, meaning they say, when you pull that money out, we'll tell you what you can get. And so if you're planning on using it for other things like a home, maybe you're going to save for retirement, it's not worth the extra 1% or so that you get in interest to lock it up for that period of time. So I'd rather have you for sure keep some of it just in a very liquid account that doesn't bear any interest, and then maybe put another portion of it in a longer-term CD. Wendy, are you and or your husband working outside the home?
Yes, we're both working.
Okay. Are you maximizing...
Wait till I retire. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, are you maximizing your retirement plan contributions?
Yes.
Okay, good for you. And Roth IRAs as well, if you qualify?
I have a Roth IRA, I don't believe he does.
Okay, that might be a good use for the money as well, because you can slide the money over into a Roth IRA again, assuming you qualify for one. Your income has to be below certain amounts, but you do have to have earned income or be married to a person who has earned income. But then you can move the money into the Roth IRA slowly and still have access to it, because you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want with no taxes or penalties whatsoever at any time. And in the meantime, the earnings can remain in there. The earnings will be sheltered from taxation, and then they'll be tax-free in retirement. And if you're over 50, you can put in up to $6,500 each into your Roth IRA each year.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you, Wendy. Thanks very much for the call. You know, Kevin, because I host this show, friends will sometimes ask me, should I do this or that? It's like you don't know what you're asking. A similar question. A friend wanted to sell her home. She's single. She's divorced. She wanted to sell her home, but not buy another home. And she's like, what is that going to mean if I do that? You know, if I just put that money into an investment of some sort.
Yeah, as a good rule of thumb, if you don't know what to do with the money, do nothing with it. Just put it in the bank, credit union, whatever, earn nothing on it, but at least it's liquid, at least it's safe. And then the answer for that money usually becomes apparent. Something comes up where you need to spend it, an emergency, or you call into a radio show and they tell you what to do.
But she also just wanted to know, if she doesn't invest it into another home, does she lose half of it to taxes?
Oh, no, that's a good question.
Like that,
because actually, no, the tax situation has nothing to do with what she does with the proceeds. It's what happened or how she lived in the home. If you sell a home and you have a capital gain on it, as long as it was your primary residence for two of the last 5 years, you can shelter up to $250,000 of gains, and $500,000 if it's a married couple.
She will be so impressed with my knowledge. This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. If you have a question for him, a personal finance question for him, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for Smart Assets, and a pioneering investment vehicle is celebrating its 40th birthday. And Kevin says we have reason to join the party. Tell us about this particular option, Kevin.
Yeah, you know, 40 years ago, Vanguard created a mutual fund known as the First Index Investment Trust. It's now known as the Vanguard 500 Index Fund. John Bogle created it for Vanguard, which at the time was a division of the Wellington Investment Management Company. But this fund was the first large unmanaged mutual fund. It was just based on buying the index and the notion that all you really needed to do was match the market, if it will, not try to beat it. By not trying to beat it, you didn't have to have a management team in place. Therefore, you didn't have as many expenses. Others had tried to do this over the previous few years, but this was the first one that really did it in a big way and took off.
So now, 40 years later, how has that concept caught on?
Well, John Bogle did so well. He still has his job with Vanguard in some capacity. This is his 65th year in the investment business, and it's the fund itself has done pretty well. The Vanguard 500 Index Fund has about $500 billion in it. The Vanguard funds in general have about $1.7 trillion in funds and $3.6 trillion under management. And there are about now, in 1975 when this fund came out, there was only about $11 million in these low-cost index funds. And today there's about $4 trillion total invested for it. They have a very fast rise in the market share of all mutual funds. And part of this is reflected of the changes in attitudes of people who have had, where they're focusing more on low-cost funds rather than higher-cost managed funds.
But isn't it better to pay more to have humans making investment decisions for mutual funds?
You would think so. Mm-hmm. And yes, that if there were evidence that it could be done, especially over the long term, that would be worth it to pay more for it. John Bogle, though, did a study when he was at Princeton back in the 60s where he found that 3/4 of the funds didn't beat the index in a particular year just because of cost of management, because of trading expenses, and then because of taxes. And over the long term, it usually gets worse. Dow Jones recently did a study where they found that over the last 10 years ending in 2015, 94% of funds that invest in United States stocks did not exceed the Standard & Poor's index. So most of these funds don't beat the low-cost option. They're therefore you're paying extra for something in terms of extra expenses in the fund that doesn't necessarily guarantee better results.
So how should investors use the fund expenses to evaluate their holdings and their decisions?
It's one of the things that I think people should really look at it instead of past performance. Whenever people are trying to decide what to invest in, they always say, well, geez, this one has averaged 10% a year. I'll put it in this one. That doesn't prove anything other than it averaged 10% per year. And in every single time that you see performance mentioned by a mutual fund company, there has to be a big disclaimer that says past performance is no guarantee of future results. So I'd rather have people deal with things that they can know and can quantify. And expense ratios of these mutual funds are something they can know and quantify. So compare to other options. Now, not every single index fund may be better than a managed one or a higher expense one. For instance, there may not be a specific type of investment class available in an index fund as of yet. But in an at-work retirement plan, that's one thing you should definitely look at in your 401ks or your 403bs. And because of recent laws passed by the Department of Labor and adopted by the Securities and Exchange Commission, investors are going to have to be offered more low-cost funds as part of an option for it. They can still choose the higher-cost ones, the professionally managed ones, if it makes them feel better, but the lower-cost ones are generally going to be something that that they're going to look for. And other than just say, looking at the cost of it, I'd also like people to look at to say, what else has this fund do in terms of being an index? Is it an index I'm comfortable in? Or is it something that I'm duplicating in other types of funds that I already have?
Okay, sounds good. I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money. And our next caller is Tom in South Beloit, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. This is a good lead into my question from what you just talked about with the index funds. Based on some prior discussion by Kevin a couple years ago, I did rebalance my retirement account and got a little bit more into the time funds, where part of it is in 2020 and part of it is in 2030. But I still have 60% in stock index funds that you were talking about. I'm wondering, as I get closer and closer, where I'm going to have to take the withdrawals, if maybe I should take some more of that stock index fund and put it in the more conservative time fund and start with some 2040 now.
Yeah, just for other people's knowledge, when Tom says 2030, 2040 funds, what those mean, that means those are target date funds. Mm-hmm. And they're funds that the 2030 pertains to the year 2030. And if you put money into a fund that's a 2030 fund, what happens is it's more aggressive right now. And as the next 14 years evaporate, the fund generally becomes more conservative. It moves money out of stock funds and slowly into bond funds and money markets. So the notion is that you probably get less return the closer that you are to needing the money, but you also get less risk. So you're less likely to get a sudden big drop right before you spend it. It's hard to give you a specific asset allocation tips, Tom, especially on the radio, but you might want to look at your overall situation, say, how much do I have in stocks? You know, even those 2030, 2040 funds still have exposure to the stock market. So if you have stock funds there, then you also have full stock funds like the index fund we mentioned. You might be overexposed at a point, especially when we're near all-time highs. And depending on how close you are to retirement, it might be a little time to scale back with something that's a little bit more conservative.
Well, that's what I was asking, so I appreciate that.
All right. Thank you, Tom, for the call. Good luck to you. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. After the break, we'll have some tips on how to speed your way through the checkout line at the grocery store. And we will take more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us on your money at WPR.org or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we are going to be shopping around and try to figure out how we can get through the supermarket checkout lines a little faster. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with financial planner Kevin McKinley during this edition of On Your Money. And Kevin, new research tells us which line we should pick when we're at the supermarket.
Yeah, it's the second line.
I thought
that's
so.
The one.
I always pick the third, though.
You do? Oh,
I know. I know.
Yeah, your life has been wasted.
Wow, so really, seriously, so which one, what does the research tell me to do?
Well, it was published in the New York Times recently and elsewhere. Dan Meyer at an institute called Desmos says that it takes, on average, 41 seconds to greet the checkout person, pay for things, and then say goodbye. And then add 3 seconds on for every single item that goes through the scanner. Richard Larson at MIT says 37 billion hours are spent in line by Americans. And then Ziv Karman and Daniel Kahneman, the author of Thinking Fast and Slow, says we usually pick a short, slow-moving line versus a long one that is moving faster, which, of course, is the wrong thing to do.
Yep, that's the story of my life. I was at a rather large big box store that also had groceries in it just this weekend, and I was there for about 37 billion hours.
You were the one. You kind of did your fair share there.
So how do we get through that line as quickly as possible?
They have several tips at various sources on the web. First of all, a lot of people think that I'll go at off hours. I'll go at 10 o'clock at night for a 24-hour store. Nobody will be there. Well, guess what? There aren't also not going to have any staffing there, too. It's hard to even find a checkout person sometimes. You may want to choose stores that use the whoever's next system, where like a place like Quick Trip lines everybody up in one place, and then as the counters open up, they go to that particular one. You kind of feel like, oh yes, please pick me. Can I go with that too? In the supermarket, you make sure that the line has a separate bagger, because that's obviously going to go faster. And then look for alternate places to pay. For instance, in the supermarket, oftentimes they have a service counter. You can bring your stuff, especially if it's just a few items, up to the service counter or maybe the liquor counter, and they can scan everything else that they're in charge of just as well as they can at the normal checkout line. And a place like Walgreens, oftentimes there'll be a long line right at the front counter, but back towards the film counter, you can take things there and they'll charge you there just as well. Scope out those people in front of you, and you get to do like some instant profiling to say, does this look like a scratch-off lottery ticket buyer or not in front of me, and probably try to avoid those people. And then when you're loading your things onto the conveyor belt, if it's grocery items, place the items with the label facing the checkout person for easy scanning. If you're buying clothes, say at a big box store, remove the hangers yourself and get the tags out so they can be seen quickly. And then not only for yourself, but on the behalf of those people behind you, have your payment method and all of your coupons ready, your debit card, credit card, whatever. If you are still of a certain age and writing checks out with a pen, make sure you have your pen and your checkbook handy.
Oh, that was one of my pet peeves. Is that?
I mean,
it's like takes forever, and then finally, it's like, oh, let me try to find that.
Hang on a second. Oh, I got 4 cents here. Just a minute. Oh, it's out in the car. I'll be right back.
Right. So, I made all those mistakes at that trip. But what are the stores doing to help us get through the checkout line as fast as possible?
Well, they may not be interested in doing so because of a report from the Food Marketing Report, where they found that consumers spend $5.5 billion every single year at what they call front-end items. And those are candy, soda, and magazines that are placed right in front of you while you're waiting. You're thirsty after an hour of going through the store. The magazine headlines jump out at you, and you buy it. And I know you like your National Enquirer still. You
I
like
usually
it in
read
paper
it while
form.
I'm waiting in
of
line.
Of course you do, and then you put it back. But that also generates a lot of impulse buying of items that are otherwise have high margins but are struggling, like those particular items. So they may not be that interested in getting you through the line as quickly as you would hope.
So how about if I just go to one of those self-service or self-scanning checkout lines?
I love those things. They're my favorite to do. I kind of feel like a checkout person.
You have to look up the items all the time.
That's a little trickier to do it, but some people shy away from them for those reasons. But the industry likes it because of the lower labor costs. For instance, like in the airline industry, it costs about $3 to check in a person with a human being at the gate, but it only costs 14 cents if that traveler uses an electronic kiosk to check in. But several of these self-scanning terminals have found that there is a much higher shrinkage rate, and shrinkage is a nice term for theft. And some of the they actually do feel that with the self-scanning, a lot of the theft isn't on purpose. It's just that people don't properly scan it in. There was a study in the United Kingdom that they found after moving to self-scanning terminals, there was a 122% increase in shrinkage, meaning people not paying for things that they took home with
so
them.
So they scan, it doesn't scan, and they put it in their bag anyway.
Yeah, or they think it's scanned, and they just they pop it down, or they grab it, and then they hear a beep somewhere. You know, there's a beep around them, and they just pop it in the bag, and they don't realize that it wasn't rung up properly.
Yeah, I mean, the ones that I use just start yelling at me. And just put that in the bag or take that away. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org if you have a personal finance question for Kevin McKinley. Steve in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Steve.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. I'm about to sell a duplex, and the tax burden, my accountant figured this out for me. He believes it's going to be about $26,000. So I'm just wondering if there are good ways that you can talk about to minimize this tax burden, please.
Right. What sometimes real estate people can do is they can convert this to what's known as a 1031 exchange. And that allows you to delay the tax burden but not avoid it, because then you exchange it for a new property, and then the tax burden kind of goes with the new property. So if and when you eventually sell that one and don't convert it to a 1031 exchange, then you have to pay the taxes sooner or later. And the only time you really want to do that is if you think, boy, this is going to be a really high tax year for me. I'd just as soon not pay it. And in the future, I'll be in a lower tax bracket when I'd rather pay the account. But then you have to find a property that not only qualifies, and you have to go through the process. And do you know, Steve, has your accountant told you if the tax burden of $26,000, is it going to be a long-term capital gain?
You know, he didn't spell that part out for me.
Okay.
So he just kind of broke it down into federal and state.
Okay.
You know,
so I'm
capital
sorry.
Gain, and that's what he estimated.
Are you going to owe $26,000, or is the gain $26,000?
I'm going to owe that,
okay,
is what he's saying. Yes.
Okay, that's a significant amount of money. Are you interested in owning another property, or is one of the reasons you sold this thing is because you're not interested in that anymore?
Not really interested anymore.
Okay. Then you will have to take it. Do you have a job outside of owning this duplex?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm employed full-time.
Okay, and are you maxing out your pre-tax retirement plan contributions?
No, I'm not, but that's one of my goals.
Okay, I would definitely do that, and I would start doing it right away, because you only have 3.5 months to bump up your contributions to your 401k, and that can offset a good deal of it, not a great one. But let's say you get another $10,000, Steve, into your 401k between now and the end of the year. You'll lower that tax burden from $26,000 down to about probably $23,000. And so and it's still your money. You know, you're not investing it at anything else. So that alone will save you 20 or 30 cents on every single dollar you put inside of it. And then if you're, are you married?
Yes.
Okay. And your spouse can also should bump up the contributions as well. And then depending on your income, you may be even able to make a tax-deductible IRA contribution by April 15th of next year for this year's taxes, which could further ease your tax burden as well.
Okay. Boy, that is great advice.
It is.
It is. Aren't you glad you called, Steve?
Finally. 500 shows.
Yeah. We'll use that for false praise.
Right.
Can I ask another quick question, please?
All right. Very quickly.
Okay, so we think we'll be able to put in our pockets about $15,000, and we do have some credit card debt that we've accumulated kind of in anticipation of the sale.
Sure.
I'm assuming that's the best way to spend that $15,000.
Yeah, actually, depending on the interest rate, the better way to reduce the taxes is, like we mentioned, that great advice is put it into your pre-tax retirement plans. But if the credit cards are costing you a lot, specifically more than, say, 15% interest, you might be better off just paying off those credit cards as well.
Thanks for calling, Steve. Now we go to Natalie in Oconomowoc. Hi, Natalie.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have a question. We are looking to invest in some 529 accounts for our children. They're 6 months old and 3 years old. And I use an online calculator, and it looks like the cost for school would be about $50,000 by the time they graduate high school. Mm-hmm. And if we put $15,000 to $20,000 each child, that's kind of what the goal is, and that's how we would get there. But Is that for a four-year state school, or what would that be for?
It's hard to say. It's probably on the calculator in tiny print. Keep in mind, many of these online calculators, if you look at it optimistically, they're trying to get you to save and educate you on what the cost might be. If you look at it cynically, you would say, well, they're just trying to get me to put more money into it by scaring the cost. And so rather than try to use the online calculator to figure out something that is an unknown, not only do you not know what the cost will be, how old are your kids, Natalie?
6 months and 3 years.
6 months, 3 years. Okay, good for you. You have a long time to save. I'm so glad you're starting out early. Save what you can. But don't.
There one is now.
That's right. I'm sorry. Okay, man. I don't mean to offend you. Save more than what you can. Save what you can and don't worry about the calculator. They don't know what the cost of school will be, and who knows what college will look like in 18 years. There may be more, you know, affordable options. There may be online learning. But just do what you can and try to save enough to pay for 1 year of school by the time those two little itty-bitties are ready to go.
Okay. And, well, if we have an inheritance that we're looking to just invest directly, like all of the funds soon,
right?
Then...
Should you put it all in those plans?
Right.
Right.
We have retirement and we have other funds, but I guess what's the penalty for over-investing in a 529?
That's a good question. There's not much of a penalty because you really don't have to pull the money out at a particular time, but if you do pull it out and use it for something else, then you pay not only taxes on the earnings, but a penalty. So I would start with maybe $5,000 or $10,000 for each kid if you can, and then put in monthly deposits from that inheritance of maybe, you know, $250 a month or something like that if you can afford that.
Thank you, Natalie, for the call. And good luck to you and the babies. Nick in Plain. Hi, Nick.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Hi, Kevin. Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning to you, Nick.
My question is, how much faith do you have currently with investing with our fiat currency, considering the fact that our federal government has performed quantitative easing and printed our money almost into oblivion on the verge of hyperinflation?
I don't think Nick has much confidence.
No, I think he does. He sounds very optimistic about our future. Nick, I'm concerned about it, but then I look at the other alternatives and doing things like, you know, stocking up on Campbell's soup and Krugerrands and shotgun shells. I don't know if I want to win that contest of being the king of the zombie apocalypse if things all fall apart here. So people need some easy way to transfer wealth from one place to the other. If things go really wrong, you're right, there's a big concern for it, but there aren't any other alternatives for it other than they've been printing money up for 100 years, and so far it's generally worked. There are problems with it, but yeah, you have to adopt a doomsday scenario to take action to concern for it. And again, I'm optimistic enough to not want to win that war.
Here's an email from Riley. I really love the show, and I really appreciate all the advice I've gotten over the years. Now on to the question. So very nice preface there. Mm-hmm. Am I better off putting my children's retirement savings into an IRA instead of a 529 college savings plan? I am not using an IRA at the moment anyway.
Mm. Is it, that's a hard, I'm not sure the terms.
I'm kind of confused. Put it children's retirement savings.
If you're saving for a child's retirement, the child has to have earned income to make a contribution to an IRA, a Roth IRA. And you should use the Roth IRA generally for most kids, because most kids are in a very low or non-existent tax bracket. And they may need the money, so you want to be able to pull the contributions out at any time, which you can do with a Roth IRA. If you are saving for their college, then a 529 account like Wisconsin's EdVest is usually a better option, because the earnings are sheltered from taxation, and then if the account is used for qualified higher education expenses, there are no taxes on it whatsoever.
Very good. So what is the website of the week?
Well, it's a long string, so I'm not going to read it for you, but it is the FINRA, the Securities Industry's tool that you can use for free to compare different fund expenses from one fund to another. You enter the symbol in. They have almost every mutual fund in the database, so you can see what the cost is and what the difference is over a long period of time with a hypothetical rate of return. It's at FINRA.org, but we'll put a link to the direct site at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And time for four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard live on Tuesday mornings from 8 until 9, rebroadcast on Saturdays noon until 1. If you have a question for Kevin, you can always email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. On Your Money is produced by Bill Martins and Brianne Chasso. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.